Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Something dark is here, flying in the skies, lurking in the woodlands, swimming in the rivers, and hiding under your bed. Join me, Mark L. Watson, and Fearscape Media as we delve into the paranormal, the occult, the spiritual, and the esoteric, and peer beyond the veil. Find us everywhere you get your podcasts or search for more information at fearscapemedia.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Unsensitive, a show where we take a subject, talk with an expert, and break it down with questions that might be normally too impolite to ask. I am your host, Ray Robinson, and one of the most difficult topics that people could really talk about is suicide. Chances are good that someone you know and love has contemplated taking their own life at some point, and some may have actually succeeded. There's always a lot of talk, especially around the holiday season, on suicide prevention. But what information is actually genuinely useful to know? Well, here to give us a little bit of insight on that is mental health advocate Gordon Corsetti. Gordon, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Wonderful. Let's kind of go ahead and start out a little bit here with we see online things that the people are kind of told to look out for. But since it's the internet, there's a whole bunch of useless information that runs around out there. What are some really good primary signs to look for when it comes to seeing if somebody that you know is contemplating suicide?
Certainly. So I'm a field advocate for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and I also follow their recommendations. They have national guidelines for all sorts of different populations, but also general guidelines for suicide prevention, crisis intervention, as well as NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So those two organizations, as well as others, those two primarily, if folks want to look and figure out, dive into all the things surrounding suicide and suicide prevention, those are the resources I direct people to. And that's where I stay up to date on all my information as well. Really, when you're talking about looking at suicide ideation in somebody, right, this is a difficult thing. Even psychiatrists and therapists will say they might be able to, in a 24 to 48 hour period, maybe be able to say this person is probably going to try to do something to harm themselves. But that's about as far as they can go. And that's when you're talking about someone who is an expert and who has been involved in the care of an individual for a fairly significant period of time, mm-hmm. right? So you're looking at that as like, what can a lay person do, a family, a friend member, something to be able to like, hey, what's going on here? And probably one of the ones it's been evident in my own life, but also in some folks that I care about, is a marked change in expected / normal behavior for that individual. So folks always like, well, what if it's just, you know, are they just sad all the time? No, not quite so much. You think of bipolar disorder versus depression in this space. Somebody who is manic, that's a marked departure from their normal baseline. They can be in a crisis space mentally and be thinking about suicide or harming themselves as much as somebody who is in a severe depression is as well. So it's not just like, I'm just feeling sad. It can be those extreme highs and extreme lows. Those are kind of the danger spaces to watch out for. And so it's knowing a little bit of you know, it sounds a little off to say this, but it's held true in my experience of when you have a gut feeling that something's off, that now is the time to pursue asking some pointed but medically necessary questions so you can address what's going on with this individual that you care about, and can I get this person the help that they need? Because as once you learn that someone is thinking about ending their lives by suicide or harming themselves or someone else, now you've likely, for the layperson, reached your the level at which you can provide any kind of care. So now it's about how can we get that person care? What's the best path to do that?
Is there a way that that somebody that maybe they know that they are clinically depressed or they know they have mental anxiety issues? Is there a way that that they can catch themselves going into like a suicidal, I don't want to say suicidal tendency because of the name of the band or anything, but yeah, it would, is there a way that really you can, that you as somebody that that might have had those suicidal thoughts, is that something that you can like catch yourself doing? Is that something you can be fully aware of? Or is that something where it just kind of will kind of sneak up on them?
I can speak to my experience on that, and I can speak a little bit to the individuals I've been involved with in group therapy without, you know, disclosing their information.
Yeah.
For me specifically, I knew where I was mentally because I was actively thinking of a plan to end my life on a few occasions in my early 20s. And looking back on those years, there were precursors mentally into what I was thinking about. There is a gentleman named Thomas Joyner. He is a psychiatrist, I believe, for Florida State, if not the University of Florida. So I hope if any fans of either team get angry for me mixing those up, I apologize. But he wrote a terrific book called Why People Die by Suicide. And he pairs two particular dangers. One is the ability to enact lethality and learn lethality. I believe I'm getting that term right. And a feeling of burdensome to the people they care about. And I can track with those two things that he identified, and that I began to start feeling, it wasn't so much that I jumped from, I had a bad day or a bad moment, or I'm so depressed, I'm going to kill myself. There was an intermediate stage in my thought process where I started feeling like I was a burden to the people I cared about, that my active existence, me drawing breath, was causing the people I cared about pain. And that the only way for me to remove that for them was to remove myself, right? So there was that burdensome. So if folks are in that kind of depressive stage and they start feeling that way of I'm worthless, my life does not matter, I am hurting other people by just being alive, That's a train that is going in the direction of suicidal ideation. So for folks who, they may not, again, this is, I've had to become very introspective myself just for my own survival against the part of my brain that doesn't really like me. And I'm a bit naturally introverted. Right. So that may not work for everyone. It may not be where everybody's headspace particularly is. And that's why I need to also lean on the people in my support network. So if this is for folks who are, let's say an individual is severely depressed, that is when, and I will be in that space in the future. That might be 6 months from now. It might be 6 years from now. I don't know. So I have to prepare for that. And one of the ways I do that is by telling the folks what my tells are. And that is, if I'm not answering my phone for the people on my favorites list, who I will answer for them any time of day when I'm available, if I'm not answering them, then they have permission to keep on calling me until I do. If not, they have permission to come to my apartment, knock on my door. Some of them have keys, right? So that these are the things that I've had to do based on my experiences with depression and suicidal ideation. But on a minimal level, that could just be like, if you're not too great, happy with where your headspace is to kind of offload some of that responsibility for yourself. Just be like, hey, I need regular check-ins from people, whether that be a therapist, psychiatrist, doctor, primary care physician, whatever, best friend, teammate, coworker, mentor, whomever. That is a great way for you to start being like, hey, you know, I just need regular check-ins here from this bit. And whether you're doing great or doing not so great, that person is going to be able to more quickly identify, like I mentioned before, that marked change in behavior. Right. Mm-hmm. So that can be a way for folks who are in that headspace to adapt to it without digging too far into their mind, because they may find that a bit unsettling, which I certainly understand.
Now, one of the things that I've talked about with a lot of people that have been dating in the past, and they've dated some controlling individuals, and one of the ways that's come up frequently as a method of control over folks is saying, well, if you leave me, I'm just going to kill myself. Is there a way to really tell if there's a difference between somebody that is genuinely suicidal and somebody that is actually manipulating a situation in their favor?
For me, I'm gonna say that's a yes, but very specific to the individuals in question.
Gotcha.
This is one where you would need. So in my case, so I, with my family, with my sister, with my girlfriend, with all of my friends, I have lost the privilege to have any jokes about suicide in my personal life. Mm-hmm. I've also lost the ability to threaten that or threaten harm myself or anybody else because I've had these past experiences. So knowing that, if we were to use me as a case study on that bit, is if I were to you know, if my girlfriend's like, I'm going to break up with you, I was like, if you break up with me, I'll kill myself. That's a manipulative tactic for sure. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be taken seriously because of my past history. And right. The folks that, so that's that bit. When somebody has no, number one, history with that, no diagnosed or potentially diagnosable mental illness, ooh, we're in some rough, gray, weird waters on that space. And I default to anytime somebody says that they are suicidal or looking to harm themselves or someone else, now that is the time to take corrective action as much as I can and feel safe on my part. So if that is calling 911, because I'd rather bring out the so to speak, the medical experts, care experts who can at least get somebody safe and stable, great. And if it turns out they were manipulating me, well, they spend a night in a psychiatric ward. That's the worst of it. And then we are certainly going to have some other discussions if that's a relationship. On that front, I think I personally find it sad that an individual would throw that type of responsibility on somebody in a hurtful fashion. And it hasn't been my experience, certainly in the group therapy that I've been in, that individuals who are genuinely hurting and are sincere in that space, they want to hide that and kind of cradle that and those thoughts very close to the vest. That's not used in a fashion to keep somebody in a relationship or force somebody to choose something over something else. I find that to be in 6 hospitalizations over 15 years and God knows how many people I've spoken with and listened to in group therapy sessions. It takes a special kind of not good person to manipulate on that space. So I'd say, you know, for those listening, if somebody does, reevaluate the quality of that relationship, number one. And number two, if you can't tell if that individual is honest about what they're doing and, you know, you're doing what's right for you, call the nearest medical health services and go that route. That's the best path I can give, taking care of your own personal safety, but also the safety of the other individual.
When you don't know, take no chances, in other words.
That's kind of it. It really is a... So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, their logo is a life raft. And in any crisis intervention, suicide intervention moment, the idea is you're there as a stabilizing force. And there's only so much that you or any of us can really give in that moment when we're not medical professionals or treatment professionals in that space. But what we can do is be a lifeline and just be there for space and to make sure that individual is okay in that moment while emergency services are getting our way. Right? That's the idea here is call emergency services. Don't leave the person alone if that is safe for you to do so. And it certainly, it will inconvenience you. And I've been handcuffed and put in the back of a squad car and driven to the hospital and locked in the psych ward for an overnight, if not more nights. And it's frustrating on my end, especially when there was a time that happened that I wasn't suicidal and I was angry about that. And okay, it was a night, it was 3 nights, whatever. It's honestly, looking back on it, not that big of a deal. Whereas if the person thought the other end, and I did manage to end my life, they're going to have a whole host of guilt on that bit that we don't want people to have unnecessarily.
I follow you. Okay. Now, you had mentioned that you still kind of fight those urges. I've known several friends that have been suicidal in the past, and they've gotten the semicolon tattoo on their hand, as you've got yours as well, as a reminder that from what I understand, it means that the sentence was paused, but it wasn't the end of the sentence. That would be a period, which makes logical sense. Is it something that people that are suicidal, is it something they're going to have to wrestle with their entire life? They're always going to have to fight that tendency to consider taking their life.
It's a really great question, and it's an it depends answer. Mm-hmm. So I'll go on my front and then kind of widen out the answer here. So on my end is I live with major depressive disorder, and unfortunately, I was untreated for about 4 to 5 years. So I learned some very unhealthy coping mechanisms. And thinking about ending my life is, oddly enough, a fairly comforting thought when everything else feels out of control. And that's the dangerous kind of seductive side of those things, is it feels like something that you have control over. And that's something to latch onto, right? Like the thought of I get to check out when I want to, when everything else in your life feels like it's going, you know, up in smoke, that's an anchor point. And I think it was Jung or Proust who wrote that, like, hey, if somebody needs to think about suicide to get them through the night, let them think about suicide. Just don't do it.
Okay.
The idea on that one is, and it's easier said than done. Certainly. But the idea here is there's another quote that goes by, you know, never kill yourself when you're suicidal. You're not in a great thinking mode, but that thought can carry you through a night, which is a weird paradox to be in, and I don't wish it on anybody. It's just it's odd on that front. I have to live with the fact that I'm likely going to have major depressive disorder for the remainder of my life, and I will likely deal with suicidal ideation because that's been now a learned behavior that's fairly well ingrained in my mind because of those untreated years and what I had to do on that front. So now I've been fortunate that I had great results with electroconvulsive therapy about a year ago, and that's pushed the suicidal thoughts much further away from my consciousness mentally. So there's a much more distance there and they're less intense. So that's been a great benefit for me, because up for 15 years, I'd been dealing with a suicidal thought every day, if not more often, and usually right in front of my awareness, which is tough to deal with and live your life the way you want to. But I've kind of accepted the fact that my history and my medical condition makes it more likely that I'm going to deal with these thoughts for the remainder of my life. So I've got to build structures in my personal life and in my treatment that will prevent me from having to walk down that path again. So that's on me. And that may be for many listeners to your show, and for many folks across the country, if not the globe, who, you know, this is one of the consequences of mental illness. But it's also one of those things where, now I'll kind of widen out the scope of the answer, is people can certainly consider suicide as an option when life events just happen and they don't have a mental illness or other illness to go around there. I mean, you know, folks who go into bankruptcy or completely lose their job, we've certainly seen plenty of that with COVID and the recessions that have happened to the middle class as a result of our pandemic lockdowns and restrictions that we have. These are things where, again, significant life events, whether they're stressors on the distressing side or the positive stressors on the eustress side of, a lot of stress happens in a new marriage. A lot of stress happens with a new kid. And the brain doesn't recognize good stress or bad stress. It just recognizes stress. And that can push a person, whether they have a mental illness like I do, that can push the human brain to go in a completely non-healthy path. Because, again, that feels like something that they have control over when the rest of their life doesn't. But when they're out of that space, if they move themselves through that, maybe that's therapy, maybe that's whatever they want to do, however they manage it, and they get out of that space, maybe they never have the thought ever again. And when they're 75 and looking back on life, and it's like, that's weird. When I was 30, I had that, you know, thought to hurt. That may be a, you know, I don't mean to say it like this, but a passing fancy at that time because of the environmental, you know, trigger that happened with that. So very, you know, two very different answers to that question, but again, two very different ways in which those suicidal thoughts can manifest in the mind based on what a person's going through.
Now, I was raised Catholic, not much of one anymore. I still understand a lot of the beliefs, but the one that kind of always stuck with me was that suicide is pretty much a guaranteed one-way ticket to hell, because it is murder and you have no way of atoning for it when you're already dead. Do you ever run across folks that have their Catholic belief has actually prevented them from seriously considering taking their lives?
I've had folks who I've been in therapy with who said, you know, my religion, not necessarily Catholicism, but pretty much all major religions, and even some ones that are not as major as Catholicism or Islam or Judaism, pretty much all regard suicide as a mortal sin. Like, good things are not happening to your soul in the afterlife if you willingly take your life in this one. According to pretty much, I've done a lot of study in religions on this particular subject. It's you know, if you're not going to hell, you're certainly not going to heaven. And that certainly may be limbo or some other bit there. But Catholicism specifically, no, I haven't had anybody that I've met with says, like, you know, my belief in this as a mortal sin prevented me from you know, going through with my thoughts. I have had folks who are just like, you know, my. What I believe in, my faith in God or my faith in a higher power or my faith in the universe, and my understanding of certain religious precepts say that, you know, this is, I may be dealing with this, but that's a step too far. Mm-hmm. Right. I was raised originally Catholic and then Methodist for a little while. I am none of them now. I'm an atheist and I enjoy the study of religion just for how illuminates how individuals think on an individual level, but also society as a whole. And I've written on my blog a good bit about Dante's Inferno, which is still one of my favorite poems. Yeah. And you look at when he wrote that didn't become canon for what hell was from the church level. But as far as people understood hell, that was what people understood hell to be at the commoner level. Right. So seven circles of hell and all these intervening things in between that. And the suicides is the most horrific one when you look down to it, because it's all bad, but it's the only time in the Inferno where Dante goes through and he doesn't understand what's going on. And he looks to his guide, Virgil, and he's like, what's going on here? And Virgil's like, dude, you wouldn't even believe me if I told you. Just go over there and break the branch of that tree. And he does, and the tree starts screaming out, why would you hurt me? I'm already in enough pain. And then the tree expands on what's going on, and it's according to Dante's understanding of hell, or what it would be, everyone getting punished in accordance with their sin, is you gave up your earthly body, so you don't get to have one in the afterlife. You're condemned to an eternity in a tree, but not even so much that. On Judgment Day, after, you know, the thousand-year kingdom of Christ reigns, you spend the remainder of the eternity with your corpse hanging off of your limbs, and you get to see what you threw away now for the rest of eternity, while everyone else who was saved go. So horrifying, right? Yes. And that's Dante. That's visceral, and that's like he.
On another level, willies, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and it freaks you out. But I read that the entire poem every year, and I write about that particular circle, and I have a full tattoo of that on my arm as a reminder of, one, it puts my mental illness in a visible fashion, but two, it also, you know, I certainly struggled with my upbringing in this is going to be there's no way I'm going to get redemption from this, right? The fear on my end, to kind of put a point on this question or period on this question, is imagine being in so much pain in your day-to-day life that the concept of suicide is now attractive to you, but you believe you're damning yourself to an eternity of pain and bleeding and fire and horribleness for an eternity. And yet, that thought isn't enough to stop you. Like the actual feeling of this, and that's where I was at. I had felt that my current pain that I was dealing with in my mortal life was worse, and I could deal with an eternity of pain because I knew what that was. I could at least conceptualize what that was. This was just pain that didn't make any sense to me. And that's what, you know, and I got very close to ending my life on numerous occasions. And so in, you know, just using me as the example, yeah, my understanding of religion and that is a mortal sin certainly didn't deter me from doing it. And if unfortunately the statistics are to be recognized and understood is, you know, heck, even if Dante is to be thought of on that front, there are certainly Catholic suicides. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, for some people, it may be their religion may be what it is that brings them through these dark moments in their lives, if that's where they're at. And for others, it unfortunately may not. And what I have to look at in my work as a advocate for suicide prevention awareness and mental health awareness in general is that we can't rely on such, quite honestly, scare tactics to get people through this, because there's always going to be some back part of the brain, this dark corner alley of the brain that says, don't worry about that. This is the right way to go. And that is an insidious thought, and one that we need to work to get people to, yeah, see the light in a sense, but we need to get them stable in the interim, in the crisis, and then slowly show them how they're connected to other individuals. That's the path to being able to get folks out of a suicidal mindset.
Now, it hasn't been in the news a lot lately. Mainly, I think it came up a lot while Dr. Kevorkian was still alive. But assisted suicide, it's right there in the name, but a lot of people view it as something completely different. Just how different is it than what you experience? Is somebody that they're in so much pain, or they are concerned about so much drain on resources around them that they want their end of life to be their choice when it comes to literally the tail end of their lives, where they need assistance in pulling that trigger, or in the case of Kevorkian, flipping that particular switch to start the sedative to make them leave. How different is that mindset?
So that's one where, again, I'll speak more on where my headspace is for me, you know, personally, and in my, you know, I don't have a DNR on file. My grandfather did, when he passed last year, and just because of his other corresponding health issues, if he went under in physically, the doctor's like, he's probably not going to come out of this stuff, and that's just not how he wanted to live. But then there's that thing of, you know, do not resuscitate is not quite the same as assisted suicide or euthanasia, right? There's this action piece of it that is a bridge too far for a lot of people, and I understand that. And it's one of those where, again, I personally, just in terms of freedoms that somebody has as an individual, yes, I believe we all have the freedom and quite honestly the right to say when we get to leave this world. That certainly isn't shared by everybody. I get that. And that is a minefield politically, yes. In any space, wherever. But that is such a personal thing for an individual, the people they care about, and their physician, where so many factors go into that. And the interesting thing one on this one is maybe the mindset on this one is when it's suicide, it's, you know, certainly when I was in that space, it's like, I'm a burden to these other people, despite me being healthy and a reasonable member of society and a good citizen as much as I can be. And I need to remove myself because I'm causing them pain. Whereas euthanasia is, I am in so much pain, demonstrable pain on this front, or my quality of life is now so poor, there's no reasonable way that this is going to get any better from what we know about medical science and the body. And to spare myself and my family pain, grief, whatever on that end, this is how I'm going to choose. I think, quite honestly, everybody should have the right to be able to do that. And with euthanasia, at least in my limited studies of these in the countries that allow it, is you go through a lot of checks to be able to make that happen, which that should be.
Yeah.
And that is one of those things where it's one of those where it should be hard. In my mind, it shouldn't be impossible. And there should be some boxes that certainly need to be checked from your own, you know, mental standpoint, physical standpoint, family health, all those kind of things on there. But there's definitely a different mentality there. It's like, I want to escape as much pain as possible when I was in a suicidal depression. But it wasn't so much even so much my pain. It was the pain I thought I was causing others, which is a different story. And when you're talking euthanasia, you're looking at that as the whole family coming together around this, you know, even looking at my grandfather, this Zion of the family, and saying, you know, honestly looking at one another and be like, why would you want to be hooked up to all these machines for the next 4 or 5? Yeah, we can keep you breathing. Do you want that? Do we want that? And having that honest conversation, I do think that is drastically different from suicide as we know it here, but also in the way of that can be made painless, right? And it's one of those things where unless you have access to some really pricey and hard to get to drugs to begin with, there's really no way to end your life by suicide without a significant amount of pain. And that I think is also another kind of defining factor of suicide, but also defining factor of euthanasia. So that's my thoughts on that. That's a heavy question, man.
It is. Okay. But really just one more thing that kind of comes to my mind, and that's Hollywood portrayal of suicide. A lot of it tends to be, you know, like you had mentioned, we had talked about the fact that your suicidal thoughts came from your depressive episode. But it seems like in Hollywood, when they talk about people that choose to commit suicide, it's because of depressing situations, not so much what's going on in their head. A good example of that, the movie from the 80s, Heathers, where it becomes this just a popular thing to commit suicide. But I also think about one TV show where they did it rather abruptly with House.
Yes.
Cal Penn's character. He basically, they just did not see it coming. And it just had to be written that way because of Cal being let off his contract. If you know all the behind the scenes stuff, he went on to like become an administrator in Obama's administration. But it seems like that one seems to come closest to how a real suicide situation would actually occur, the aftermath especially. How much does Hollywood, TV shows, movies, how much do they romanticize suicide, and how accurate do they actually get?
It's romanticized. It's romanticized in literature, for mm-hmm. sure. On top of the fact of, you know, you wonder how many writers and poets live with some type of mental illness looking back. I mean, you just talk of Dickinson, Proust, probably Twain, Meriwether Lewis, the Lewis and Clark expedition had depression, mm-hmm. Lincoln, like all these folks who like we read their stuff and are in awe of what they are able to create and how they can give us insight into the human condition is, you know, that's the sort of depression, of mental illness, of what it can give. But it's also one of those things of it's, whether it's in prose, other written forms, certainly in television and movies, it's prone to exaggeration. Mm-hmm. That's an unfortunate thing. On it. Like nobody, there isn't a Law and Order SVU about a quote unquote boring, average criminal in this, or your run of the mill child molester in that. It just doesn't happen because it's not exciting television, right?
Right.
And that's the same thing with movies as well. And the danger of that bit is one of the things is, so I'm a writer, I speak, and I'm very much a believer in the power of language and of words to raise consciousness across populations and improve knowledge on an individual basis. And there's also a lot of responsibility that comes with how things are discussed and how things are presented, which is why, and I follow the AFSP's guidelines on this is I've eliminated commit suicide from my vocabulary because that does have even more negative connotations behind that. It's like committing someone to an institution. They've committed a crime, even if they've just thought about it, right? Yeah. You say die by suicide or attempted to harm themselves, things of that nature. It's a softening of language, and folks may get on me for being like, oh, you know, you're censoring yourself. I'm like, yes, I am, because I've been in that space and I know what those thoughts feel like, and I don't need the additional stigma from society. But to really address your question of the problem with portrayals of mental illness, especially, and then suicide, doubly so, in pop culture, in song, and in movies, is it's always extremes. The example that you did there with Cal Penn and House, and I remember watching that episode. I think I was a teenager at the time, and I was like, "Oh my! What just happened?" And yeah, when you're like, when you see the backstory of what happened as to why they had to write him out so quickly, that was the only option they really had, short of maybe like he's in a horrible car accident. But they decided to go the suicide route because that then gives him a deeper connection to the main protagonist to be able to go into the mind of House. And so that was a carefully constructed decision to make things more interesting, right? So there's a danger there. And it's the same reason when I talk to students as well about the danger of following certain things on Instagram. Like, I follow things that will empower me. I don't like following stuff that's going to drag me down. And I have choice over what pops up on my feed. And the same kind of thing here is I see depictions of mental illness and suicide in television and movies that rub me the wrong way. I think maybe A Star Is Born.
Uh-huh.
So okay. A Star Is Born may be from my, I thought Silver Linings Playbook the few years before that was just a great view of what bipolar, manic depressive, just depression looks like in general and the challenges of relationships and family dynamics and that. I thought that was quite honestly very well done. A Star Is Born, I couldn't finish that movie because I knew where that main character was going when he went to the garage.
Yeah.
And I cried with my family because I was like, it had been 10 years since I had made that particular attempt. And one of my attempts had been via hanging. And so that was an emotional moment for me. And I think how that movie showed just how important it was. Like, yes, that man did have people that cared about him, and the protagonist had a partner that was deeply cared about their well-being, and some outside opinions from some individuals was enough to override what that person logically understood, and then led that character then to end their life by hanging. And that's where, again, I'm very careful about how I consume information, and I'm very careful about how I talk to myself. And the unfortunate thing is when stuff's just in front of people via screens is you may not have that mental filter to be able to be like, oh, this is just sensational for the sake of being sensational. Mm-hmm. This is not a real portrayal of things. And just to kind of wrap everything up here on this one is, you know, to kind of tie in A Star Is Born with that episode on House with Cal Penn's character, is that there is, and the research bears this out, almost always a suicidal individual reaches out in some form or fashion. It is incredibly difficult to keep that a secret. I certainly know that as well. And the hiding of that is evident, unfortunately, a lot of times in hindsight. But there are many times when individuals will say, you know, I'm hurting, I'm thinking about hurting myself, I'm thinking about suicide, and that falls on deaf ears. Or it's not deaf ears, but, oh, you're just going through a moment. Oh, you're just going through this. Yeah. We'll talk about it in the morning. And the morning never comes for that individual, right? So that's why to go back to what I said earlier of get emergency services. Like the worst thing that you can do for a suicidal individual is leave. If you don't feel safe with that individual, then yes, you have to protect yourself and call emergency services. But if it's within your power to stay there and be with that person and be a life preserver in that moment while emergency services come, that's the thing to be doing. And the idea in this crisis situation is that you're providing time for them to get out of that super stressed fight or flight mentality, which is not shown in popular culture. That's the part that gets missed. It's always this, oh, he never did it. In the same way of just like, oh, the murderer was always such a nice guy. These are tropes, unfortunately. They do not mimic real life. And when they do happen, And like I said, like in A Star Is Born, I will be quick to praise that.
Mm-hmm. That kind of that actually jogged another thought. One of the things that I've noticed with online streaming now is that at the beginning of each show, when they show the rating, now they're actually including suicide as one of the things that they say will occur during the episode. When you see something like that, does that make you just determine whether or not you want to keep watching the show if you didn't know anything about it beforehand?
A very good question, a good observation, and I've seen that as well. I think it's useful. I really do. And it's one of those things of, I'm a huge reader, mm-hmm. right? And I've read a lot on suicide and a lot of stories on that. And it's you know, again, go back to the Inferno. When you read and he talks about the seventh circle, it's called the Wood of the Suicides. I know what I'm getting into, right? I have full power to just close, stop, and done. I don't really get that on a Netflix show. Mm-hmm. Right. So when that is put at least front and center, just be like, hey, by the way, this might mess you up. Right. Not saying that it will or that you're weak mentally. It's just that this is kind of a nice thing to have. And it's the mental equivalent of when I was a little kid and Pokemon was huge and they had to pull an episode because thousands of kids in Japan got epileptic seizures because of the flashing and they had to tone that down, but also put warnings on that for all of you. That's kind of the same deal here of, this is something that we know can send people down a darker path. I'd avoid it if I need to, but if I'm in a good mental space, then that's something that, you know, I'm certainly going to watch. Like watching the Nat Geo thing on trafficking is a very difficult thing to watch, and it's on my to watch list because I feel it's important to become more knowledgeable about that. And I know it's going to be heavy, so I'm going to take care of myself in the watching of that. And if I need to pause and step away or turn it off and come back to another day, then I'll do that. But when that's not evident in something, when that's just going to be thrown in the middle part of an episode and you have no idea that's coming, that can be a whiplash effect mentally. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very glad that's one of those things that is coming forward. And it's not a censoring thing in any means. It's just a hey, heads up. You know, in the same way a friend is going to sit you down if they're having a rough time and be like, I'm going to drop something on you. Are you ready for this? That's the equivalent in my mind.
Well, Gordon, I really appreciate you coming on and telling us a little bit more about the processes and giving some of your own experiences as well. If folks can actually kind of chase down and find out more information about what you provide as far as those services go, or just other services that you think are great to explore, tell us a little bit where they can find that information, especially on yourself.
Happy to. If anybody wants to find anything about me or reach out to me at all, you can go to my website. It's mentallyagile.com. I run a writing and speaking organization called Mental Agility. And my website, I post on it regularly, almost every single week. I do monthly newsletters. I put up videos of me doing different therapeutic techniques and trying out different things, both from a physical side and a mental side, so folks can get a flavor of kind of what could work for them if they're interested. I have different tools for different populations, so student athletes, working professionals. I'm building out some for college players or for college students and high schoolers as well. That kind of just puts everything in a nice package for, you know, what you may be going through based on where you're at in your season of life. But also, if anybody wants to follow me on social media, I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and Instagram, just search for Mentally Agile or Mental Agility. I'll pop right up. I'm more than happy to have a dialogue with anybody via, you know, whether it's phone, text, or email. I'm more than reachable, and that helps me in my, personally, my continued therapy, and it also helps me in my advocacy work to kind of know where people's heads are at and what they're most wanting to learn about. So again, mentallyagile.com, and Gordon Corsetti, love to hear from anybody.
Wonderful. And thank you so much for taking the time to enlighten folks that are listening here today. And just a personal thank you for your advocacy for people that need your assistance, for you taking what could be a detriment in your life and turning it into something very positive, a great force for improving others' lives. So thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
And now a challenge to some of the other listeners. If you also have a subject that you're passionate about, like Gordon is here, you can speak some authority on, and you're not afraid to tackle some of the tough questions that might come your way, then please, I want you to reach out to me here at Unsensitive. You can reach out through the Fearscape Media Network, or you can write me directly at rayrobwrites@gmail.com, and maybe you'll be the next one on our show. A special thanks to Ben Sounds for the use of the song Happy Rock, and of course for the fine folks at Fearscape for giving me a venue. And thank you, you've been listening to Unsensitive. We'll talk again soon, and until then, keep your mind open.